Hi, and welcome to Common Denominator, straight-up conversations with me, Moshe Popak. This week, renewable energy and how it's changing the planet. My guest is Dr. Jean-Hubert Olivier, an assistant professor of chemistry at the University of Miami and the principal investigator of the Laboratory of Functional Nanomaterials. Welcome to the show, Jean-Hubert.
Good afternoon.
So I'm really excited to talk to you about your lab and the work that you're doing with solar energy. Tell us a little bit about it.
So the world that we are living in is what we are calling the macroscopic world, which means that as human, right, I can interact with a computer, I can interact with a ruler. If I want, I don't know, to fix my house, I have tools that I can, you know, take, buy at Home Depot, and I can do stuff with it, right? Now, of course, the situation is different when we start looking at extremely small objects, okay? So the type of structures and materials that my lab is doing, the scale is what we are calling nanometer. And basically, you have 1 billion nanometer in 1 meter, okay? So which means that you need to develop new tools really to manipulate structure at this dimension, because of course you cannot really touch them with your hand, right? And that's really where us as chemists, we are kicking in. And so what my lab is doing and what we have been focusing on over the last 5-6 years at University of Miami, we are developing new tools to construct extremely small materials that are not only able to absorb light coming from the sun, but to convert this light into energy, and also to transport this energy into specific location at extremely small dimension.
I really liked when we spoke before before the show, the Lego example. Mm-hmm. I think that was a very practical example.
Yeah. One way that you could think about what we are doing, right, you can imagine that all of these molecules that we are working with are small pieces of Lego, okay? And so, of course, when you go to the store, you buy, you know, your favorite Lego. Basically, all of this Lego comes in a plastic bag. Now, let's say that you open that plastic bag and you throw it on your carpet. What you're going to have is a scattered mess of Legos on your carpet, right? It doesn't spontaneously organize into the structure that it has been designed for. And so what we do right in my lab is that we really pre-program molecules, and we develop tools to pre-program these molecules to spontaneously organize into these structures, okay? So now what we are able to do, right, is schematically speaking, we can take this bag of Lego, we can throw it on the floor, and spontaneously it's forming whatever structure that we want it to form. And of course, the function of these structures is to be able to harvest light and to do work with it.
So in other words, that's from a practical standpoint, what would you say on moving forward on the future from a practical standpoint that would do?
So what we are doing, we are really trying to mimic what nature has been doing for a billion years, right? Photosynthesis. And so again, if you look at this amazing machinery that nature is, the really the longstanding goal is to be able to build this structure in the solid state that, for example, will be able to harvest light and, let's say, generate chemical fuels, for example, hydrogen or oxygen. And basically, hydrogen and oxygen are clean energy in many ways, right? Because when you burn them, the only thing that is coming out of it is basically water. So that's actually very useful. It's very different than coal, which I'm sure we're going to talk about a little bit later.
Sure. And in general, how much of an impact, if there was complete buy-in on solar energy, how much of an impact do you think we can have on the world?
Well, I mean, again, I'm very optimistic when it comes to solar energy. Obviously, that's, you know, that's my bread and butter. But I think we could literally change the world in many ways, because, again, I think that the technology is there now, for sure. Over the last couple of years or decade, that was really a matter of decreasing the price, right, of solar energy. And I think that we are slowly getting there. But again, if you look at the influx of what we are calling photons in my field, right, it's this quantum of energy coming from the sun. I mean, you could definitely have enough energy for the whole world at very specific location, right? So I don't think it's really a problem right now. The main problem is really to put it mainstream and to be able to have this technology adopted essentially by the rest of the world, I think.
And I remember just a couple of days ago, I was talking to a friend of mine, and we were talking about Nikola Tesla. And that, you know, I don't know how true that is. Maybe you would be able to enlighten us, but that actually he figured out a way how to harvest energy for free for the world. I wonder if that could actually happen, in your opinion.
I mean, nothing is free, right?
Right.
And in science is particularly true. And I'm not talking about funding and funding agencies. I'm really talking about like thermodynamic, what we're calling thermodynamic, right?
Right.
And so I think that you always have penalties, right? When you harvest energy from a system. And so the yield will never be 100%. However, when we talk about, when people are mentioning this concept of free energy, for me, right, in our field, the sun is free energy because it's coming from free, right, from space in many ways, right? And because of this change of temperature and change of pressure at the surface of the Earth, right, then we have wind. And then in that case, wind is also free energy, right, in many ways. So, yeah, I mean, I think that we can, in that sense, we can talk about free energy, and that's totally fine, right? But then I would also argue that, you know, fossil fuel and coal is also free energy, right? Because it's in the ground, but I think the impact is way different.
I want to ask you about the COP26 conference, but first, I just want to remind our listeners, this is the Common Denominator podcast, and my guest is Dr. Jean-Hubert Olivier, an expert in renewable energy. If you're enjoying this episode, please subscribe on YouTube or wherever you listen to podcasts, and we'd be grateful for any 5-star ratings. Plus, we'd love to hear from you. If you have feedback about the show, send us your comments on Twitter at mpopac. Now, back to the show. I know, obviously, we just had 2 weeks of the COP26 in Glasgow. From your perspective, what were your main takeaways? What do you feel? Do you think that there was a material conclusions and actions that are going to be taken?
I think right now, you know, I'll tell my feeling, right? My true feeling is that it's mixed bag, I would say. Because again, and everybody was talking about it in the news, and that's definitely something that resonated with me, this language that they use about, you know, phasing down and not phasing out. Again, that tells a lot about the mentality, I think, of, you know, the big leaders in terms of how they approach coal. And again, right, it's, don't take me wrong, I understand it's a complex problem, right? Because, you know, you have economy in play and so on and so forth. But I think that's the pessimistic side of things, right? The optimist side of things, what I'm seeing now is that you have these big leaders, right, that agree that they need to act on climate change, right? And again, right, it's when you look at, you know, the reaction of China at the end of the summit, right, I'm not sure to what extent they are serious, but the fact that they are willing to play ball now in terms of climate change, right, it's basically a change of language, right? I don't think that we would have seen that like 10 years ago. And I'll definitely take that as a positive, right? Now, let's be frank, right? 1.5 degrees Celsius, basically to maintain global warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius, that's going to be very complicated. I mean, I think we are too late for that. But we are not too late for 2 degrees Celsius, I think so. And that's my positive view of this summit, right? Is that at least now people start to realize that we have a problem. And it's not just one, and it's probably one of the first time in human history, right, that it's not just one country who has a problem, it's the whole world together, right? Because it's either everybody is willing to play game or basically we are screwed.
Right. And I did notice, you know, you mentioned China, president of China, president of Russia, big, contributors to the issue on climate change, but they did not go to the summit, right? So that I felt, I was like, okay, this is a little bit of an issue.
No, absolutely, and you're right. I mean, I think that you're far to be the only one feeling that way, and I felt that way as well, right? Because what is more important than to attend this summit right now? You know, that's what I told myself, but it just tells you, right, that we are at the very beginning of a very long process, I think. in terms of, you know, sensitizing people, and it comes also to sensitizing, you know, the leadership of these specific countries. Now, you know, I just want to say also is that, you know, not that long ago, 2 years ago, we had the president here who was climate denial, right? And so, you know, when you see that, you kind of wonder also, you know, it's easy for big countries to just deny it and just, you know, slide it under the rug and just move on essentially. Because at the end of the day, and I'm just sidetracking a little bit from the question you asked, but I think it's really a matter of, you know, short-term and long-term vision, right? The big impact of this climate change, we're gonna really feel it in around 50 years from now, right? 50 to 60 years from now. So of course, for leadership and for politics, I mean, 50, 60 years, it's almost infinity, right? For a scientist, 60 years ago, it's 60 years, and in the future is basically tomorrow. So there is also like, you know, a time frame that has to be considered in politics and in science as well. It's definitely not the same time frame.
Yeah, and I did see the developing nations, you know, making a plea for substantial dollars. I think it was over, a hundred and something billion dollars a year. And developed countries were like, okay, yeah, we'll give the money, but they haven't given that money. So we have many countries that don't have the money to become towards that journey, carbon neutral.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's one aspect of the problem. It's again, as I said earlier, it's a complex problem. And what you have just mentioned is as important as the other aspects, right? Because you have these climate vulnerable nations, right, as they are calling it, that basically don't have the means really to sustain this technological advancement. And I strongly believe that that's where these big leaders that we are, right, the US, China, India, they have to step in, right, and say, hey, you know, we are here, we're gonna, you know, show you the way, and we're gonna work together to get there. Because again, right, it's as I said before, it's really it's either everybody's doing it or basically nobody's doing it, right? So it's, and that's again, that's also a logistical challenge in many ways.
So in other words, you're happy, I guess we just passed this infrastructure bill. Mm-hmm. And you're happy that for the U.S. to be kind of a role model on this journey.
Right? No, absolutely. Because, you know, I think it's important that we not only financially, right, because it's an investment for the future, but also, I mean, I'm just thinking, and again, I'm sidetracking a little bit, but, you know, for history textbook, right, in 200 years, I mean, you know, these people, they're going to look at us and say, what the hell have you done? And having like this, you know, having like somebody like the US, right, taking the lead of in that respect, and really setting up the ground rules in order to get away from, you know, fossil fuels. I mean, that's super important, and I think that we can do it definitely. And in many ways, that's our role to do it, right? Why? Because again, we are, you know, the most powerful economy in the world. So if we are not doing it, who's gonna do it?
Yeah, I know that they talk about. Or what is it, 50% towards carbon neutral by 2030. And then I think it was, by 2050, you know, carbon neutral completely. Based on what you're seeing, realistic, right? It comes from the top-down leadership. We're going into 2022. We have 8 years till 2030. Are we taking the right steps? Is this actually, as a scientist, is it actually attainable?
I don't think it is. I mean, I mean, 8 years again, it's a very short time frame to work with. We are talking about, you know, infrastructures. We are talking about processes that takes years, you know, to be put in motion. So I don't think it's realistic. But I think that the way that I took it, right, again, as a scientist, is that, you know, you set up this really huge goal in order to achieve at least half of it, I would say. And anything that we can achieve now will be beneficial for the future, right? But again, as you said before, it's one step in the right direction. Now, that's just the beginning of the journey, right? And I don't think that 8 years will be enough. But again, I think that these, you know, these very unrealistic goals are being set just to move everything forward, essentially. Because again, once you gain momentum into this direction, then more and more people will buy into it, right? And then, you know, it's the snowball effect, right? And eventually we'll be able to do something. But again, right, this, reducing 45% by 2030, I think that's completely unrealistic. But that's just my, again, that's my own opinion.
And I saw recently also President Biden, had this idea by 2030 to, on the wind energy side, kind of set up offshore, you know, offshore wind to power 10 million homes. Do you think that that's actually possible in the next 8 years to produce, I guess, 30 gigawatts of power?
What I've seen in wind energy is that it's an amazing source of energy. What I mean by that, I mean that I think that, so first of all, wind energy is way cheaper than solar energy, right? I think that wind energy is something around 1 cent per kilowatts, whereas solar energy based on the DOE, Department of Energy, it's, I think, 6 cents per kilowatt. So it's you know, it's six times cheaper than solar energy. I think also if you think about, you know, setting up this wind farm versus setting up solar farm, I think that wind farm logistically are easier to be set up. So that's definitely a plus. One thing to realize as well, you know, when we compare solar energy and wind energy, right, is that wind, you have it 24/7. Sun is not 24/7, right? So that's also something that is definitely going for wind energy. So again, these 30 gigawatts, that may be a lot, right? But I think that, again, we could definitely get there. Maybe not by 2030, but even if you are, let's say, you know, best case scenario, you are 5 years late on your timeline and it comes by 2035. At the end of the day, you still have, you know, 10% of renewable energy in your country. So I don't think that you should penalize somebody by being late on the delivery. But I think that really what we need to work on is really having this, breaking down the energy consumption in terms of how much are we allocating per which renewable energy source, right? Because again, solar energy won't solve everything. Wind energy won't solve everything. But if you start combining all of these resources together, then basically you can start thinking about basically having a country that is fully carbon neutral.
So obviously you're extremely passionate about solar energy. When did you first fall in love with science in this space? Kind of your personal journey.
I don't even remember, right? I mean, you know, I was one of these type of kids where, you know, I remember being at my grandma's house and I was basically, you know, tearing apart appliances and, you know, really going into, like, you know, trying to understand how, you know, blender worked or whatever. And so, you know, I remember going to the hardware store and saying, because of course at this time we didn't have internet, right? I was showing up and say, what is that piece? What does it do, right? And so, of course, you know, throughout my curriculum, right, I arrived to middle school and actually I started taking chemistry at the end of middle school. In Europe, you could do that at this time. And so obviously I felt in love with chemistry really earlier on, because I found it like fascinating, right? Really small molecule and being able to manipulate and create these materials with crazy functions. And so I obviously started my undergraduate career at University of Strasbourg in Alsace, close to Germany. And as a chemistry major, I decided to do a PhD in chemistry also at University of Strasbourg. And then I moved to Duke University to work with somebody else that I really wanted to work with, Professor Michael Therrien. And then I really started, you know, putting together my expertise and trying to understand what in my field we are calling light matter interaction, right? How we can develop and, well, design and develop materials that interact with sunlight essentially and do, you know, specific functions. And after my journey at Duke, I spent like almost five and a half years. And again, that was amazing. I'm working over there. Then I came here at University of Miami where I started my lab, right? I consider myself extremely lucky.
So I want to just tell you, it's definitely, as a layperson, getting your insight, you know, from someone's deep in the science, it's definitely insightful. So I definitely appreciate that. And I want to I know the listeners probably would want to learn more about you. How can they go ahead and do that? And the work that you're doing.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it's it's very easy. They can just Google my name. And I think that the first link that they will find is my website, my lab website. And they can basically follow us on Twitter as well, because I have the Twitter handle on my lab website, and you know we can take it from there.
Well, I want to thank you, Jean-Hubert. Thank you so much. It's really been great and a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Common Denominator podcast. Join us next week for another inspiring, impactful, and empowering conversation. To learn more about Moshe, head to moshepopak.com. If you enjoyed this episode, feel free to share it. And we'd be grateful if you could rate, review, and subscribe to the show.